Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Women's Bean Project. Familiar with it? I wasn't. Founded in 1989, this nonprofit, based in Denver, Colorado, is dedicated to helping women break the cycle of unemployment and poverty through on-the-job training and life skills coaching. Because, quote, when you change a mother's life, you change her family's life. Women's Bean Project helps them develop the work and interpersonal skills needed to function independently in both the workplace and the community. My guest today is Tamara Ryan, the CEO of Women's Bean Project, a position she's held since 2003. Tamara defines her role as the visionary leader and organization spokeswoman, a position she's eminently qualified for. She's had more than 20 years of marketing and sales experience. She's the chair of the board of directors for the Social Enterprise Alliance and was recently named one of 2017's top 25 most powerful women in Colorado. Tamara is the author of The Third Law, which highlights the societal obstacles and internal demons that must be overcome for marginalized women to change their lives. The book won numerous awards for women, minorities in business, and social activism. So, Tamara, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Sandy.
So let's start by my asking you to share the Women's Bean Project backstory. How does it work? Who benefits? Is it a national program? Go for it.
Well, at Women's Bean Project, we believe that women have the power to transform their lives through employment. So we hire women who have been chronically unemployed, and we teach them to work by making nourishing products, which started with bean soup and today is about 35 different food products. We do this in the context of our business, and the women learn the skills of working while they're also learning basic life skills. And it all works together over a period of 6 to 9 months. And at the end, a woman graduates and moves to what we call a career entry-level job in the community. And that's a job where she can advance and prosper and honestly often feel valued for the first time in her life. And this all started in 1989 as part of a program that our founder wanted to start because she saw that homeless women were caught in this cycle of unemployment and homelessness. And she would see the women come to a shelter where she was volunteering, and they'd use the services of the daytime shelter, and then they'd leave because they'd get a job. But the same women kept coming back over and over again. So she thought, if I could teach these women to work by actually working, that would be the cure for poverty. And she invested $500 of her own money and bought beans and put two women to work. And that was the genesis of our organization.
Oh my gosh, $500 and several bags of beans, and look what that has spawned?
Well, it is pretty amazing. That first holiday season in 1989, they made $6,100. And I think that was actually the first realization that perhaps it could be a going concern. I know she didn't do it because she wanted to start a business. She did it because she wanted a means through which to teach the skills.
What was the founder's name?
Her name is Jossie Eyre.
All right. So Jossie had, I'm guessing, if we can speak for her, no idea what this would spawn?
Oh, in fact, she has told me that when someone ordered a case of soup, which is 12 units, she couldn't believe anyone wanted that many. And today we will ship pallets of soup across the country. We're in about 1,000 stores across the U.S., and we work with some of the country's largest retailers.
You know, I have to tell you that there really is an amazing, wonderful tie that binds the women who I have had the good fortune and pleasure to meet as I host my show. They get an idea, and nothing stops them from not only giving birth to it, but raising it through childhood and continuing on and on and on. It's astounding to me.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think we all look around and see things we don't like, but we don't all do something about it. And I have tremendous respect for people who do.
But sometimes that can just seem like such an overwhelming task, you know, to start. And I always use this phrase, you know, pushing that rock up the hill.
Well, a lot of things in life are like that.
That's true.
But I think that when we decide to make a community our home, I feel really strongly that we make a commitment to that community, and we have a responsibility to the community to make it better. And however you want to define community, I think that's up to each person. But I do believe that every investment we make in terms of helping other people make their lives better is better for all of us. It's not possible to live in a vacuum where only your actions are affecting you. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. I also think in our country, we have a tendency to lose sight of the fact that there are people who live down the street from us who are living in poverty and who are who have the potential to get out of poverty, but don't have a clear path and actually could get there if they were given a clear path. And that's what I see every day. I watch women who on the first day we hire them won't look me in the eye because they come across as angry and resentful. And what I see happen over the 6 to 9 months they're with us is that they literally blossom and they become the women I think that they were meant to be. And more importantly, they begin to believe they're worthy of a better life. And I don't know how you measure that, but you sure know it when you see it because it's such an amazing transformation that happens. And really the most significant piece of feedback we get is that someone finally gave them a chance to learn the skills that they needed, not just to get a job, but to keep it.
Well, these are invisible women.
They are. And they're disenfranchised from our society in pretty much every sense. They don't have the financial means to vote with their wallets. Often they don't have voting rights because of their addiction and felony backgrounds. There's no one representing their interests, if not those of us who do this kind of work.
How many women have been served?
It's about 1,000. It started with the 2 in 1989 and has grown. Today, in a year, we'll serve about 80 women. And those are the number of women that we hire who work for us and then graduate our program. So they come through, 80 women will come through in a year. What I think is even more significant is that every woman has an average of 3 children. When you think about that ripple effect of what that creates when you change a mother's life, and in terms of the opportunity to change her family's life. I come to work every day thinking about 2 things. One is that we have to hire every woman who needs us. And how we do that is by increasing sales. Ultimately, for us, sales create jobs. But then the second part that I think is even more important is that when we hire a woman, we need to make sure that our services are so effective and far-reaching that she's the last in her family to need us. Because otherwise, in 20 years, we're going to be serving the daughters of the women we serve today. I don't think that's okay.
Take me through the process of when a woman first comes to you. And does she find you or you reach out?
It happens both ways. The number one way that women find us is from a referral from someone else who's been in our program. And that's really a reflection of intergenerational poverty. We'll have a woman and her cousin and her aunt and her sister and her mother over a period of time. And they will refer one another to us because the first person had success and then they refer. So it's a regular kind of application process. We require that the women come to our location to fill out that application. We're in Denver, just north of downtown Denver. Mm-hmm. We're in a cool old firehouse that we bought from the city many years ago, and that's our manufacturing facility, and everything is made here and shipped from here. So they come here and fill out the application. And that's the first step. Then we call them back for an interview. They have to arrive on time, dressed appropriately, with a good attitude. We will have given them some instruction about that. So we're checking their ability to follow direction. And then we bring them back a second time, and they actually do kind of a tryout on our production line where they're seeing what the work is actually like. Because this interview process is kind of a two-way street. We want to make sure that each woman understands what we're going to expect from her, but we also want her to understand what she can expect in return. Because we're not a regular employer. 70% of her paid time that she spends with us is going to be spent working in the business in some way. It's going to be on the production line, maybe in the shipping department, doing the work of our manufacturing operation. And then 30% of her paid time is going to be spent in program activities where we're going to help her focus on meeting her basic needs, which are housing, transportation, childcare, healthcare. Those are things that are not directly related to employment, but certainly indirectly, and would prevent her from being able to come to work every day.
So you provide a variety of critical services.
Well, or we connect her with the services within the community. It doesn't make sense for us to be the healthcare provider or the childcare provider because there are lots of better ones in the community. But we help her learn the critical thinking skills around problem solving that allow her to get that housing or to get the childcare. And that's really crucial to our philosophy, that we don't get the housing for the woman. We don't get her the next job. We help her learn the skills so that she can do those things herself. Because if we did it for her, she'd get it once. But if she does it, she could do that over and over again.
Are there other products that you offer?
We have about 35 different food products today. It started with bean soup. We have 6 different soup mixes. We're a dry food manufacturer, so everything we make is a mix. We have cookie mixes and brownies and chocolate-covered espresso beans and jelly beans because, you know, the bean theme. We also have spices for salsas and spice rubs and dips. And all of these are assembled at our facility and then shipped from here.
How many women do you employ?
Our staff is 13 full and part-time, and with one man currently. We try not to call him our token, but he kind of is at the moment.
And the women come from?
Denver metro area. There's roughly a 6 or 7 county area where we would receive women. Every woman is sort of in a different situation, but many of them are in a halfway house. So they've recently been released from prison. They land in a halfway house and they need to find a job in order to pay to be there. So they're finishing their sentence within the correction system while they're working for us. And then others are referred through workforce development programs where the government is trying to help the women move from welfare to work. Sometimes treatment programs. A lot of shelters. Many communities are having low-income housing problems, and Denver is definitely one of those communities. So we are seeing an increase in homelessness at time of hire.
Would you venture to say that just about every woman has been a success story?
No, not every woman. I mean, there have, certainly in the time that I've been here, there have been heartbreaks. I would say, though, that even if a woman, about 70% of the women finish our program, complete our program. So in 6 to 9 months, she's going to work on all the skills that we were talking about. And then at the end, about 70% are going to complete the program and then go on to a job in the community. We have pretty close to 100% job placement. A few women will go on to education rather than employment. Then we track them every 6 months after they graduate, really to check to see if change sticks. And we pay them $50 to check in with us every 6 months. And we intentionally made that a dollar amount that would be motivating because, frankly, I'd check in for $50.
Mm-hmm.
And so the women check in with us, and we know that at a year, 95% of these formerly chronically unemployed women are still employed.
Isn't that fabulous?
And one of our criteria for hiring is that a typical woman we hire hasn't had a job longer than a year in her lifetime, though the average age is 38. And I find that people are surprised by that. That
it's so old, so to speak.
And some of that, I think, is that when you're in your 20s, regardless of your circumstance, you still feel bulletproof. And you really haven't yet seen the manifestation of your choices. You don't see what your life is going to be like. It's harder to, I guess, project what your life is going to be like in 20 years when you are 20 or in your 20s. And I think then by the time you are in your 30s, 40s, and certainly by the time you're in your 50s, you know what your life is going to be like. And I think we find that women are much more motivated to make changes as a result.
And what would you say the percentage of the women are who are moms?
Oh, almost all.
Almost all of them.
So in every group, we might have one woman. I would say 99% of the women are moms.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Tamara Ryan, who is the CEO of Women's Bean Project, a nonprofit based in Denver, Colorado, dedicated to helping women break the cycle of unemployment and poverty through on-the-job training and life skills coaching. Let's get personal now, Tamara. How did you get involved in Women's Bean Project? And while I'm asking the questions, tell us about your making the move from the private to the public sector.
Well, I was in the private sector. I was a marketing and business development professional, and I worked in a lot of different industries, from for-profit education to technology. And I was working for a tech company at the time in 2003. And I began to volunteer at Women's Bean Project. And a lot of my attraction to volunteering was the fact that I didn't have a lot of connectedness to my community. My clients, when I worked for this tech company, were all over the world. And it was really fun work. But I wanted to find a way to be connected to my local community. And so I began volunteering on the sales and marketing committee. And I did that for about 6 months. And then the position of CEO came open. And I thought I knew the perfect candidate. And that was my friend, Sarah. So I tried to talk Sarah into applying for the job. And according to her, she still tells the story. I went on and on about what a great place it was until finally she said, if you think it's so great, why don't you do it? And so, I think my resistance initially was just that I did not see myself as a nonprofit professional. It's hard for me to even know what I thought that was at the time. But her point was that Women's Bean Project happens to be a 501c3, a nonprofit company, but it is a business. And the better the business does, the more women can be served, which is actually what attracted me to volunteering in the first place, that I could bring my marketing and business development skills to a place that would have social impact. And that's why I'm here still today, because I get to do that. Only now I get to meet these women and I get to see this transformation that occurs. And, you know, if we're lucky in our lifetime, we find something that we can feel passionately about really see that we've made a difference. And it's pretty amazing when you can find that.
In spite of the fact that you're a 501c3, where does your money come from and what is your yearly operating budget?
We're about $2.2 million operating budget. About 70% of that comes from sales. So it's products that we sell all across the country through a pretty wide variety of retailers. And then we fundraise the remainder. About 10% is grants, private foundation, and the remainder is individual donors.
What do you envision for Women's Bean Project? Do you see it getting larger? Do you see some kind of diversifying, or you're just happy with the way things have been and will stay that way?
Oh, Sandy, I'm never a kind of person who's happy with the way things are.
Oh, then that was a good question.
Well, we are focused right now on growing. And we're growing by increasing sales of our current products, but also increasing the number of products we offer. So we will have some new products coming out in early 2017. And we're pretty excited about that. And really, it's all focused on the objective to not turn any women away. So I've recently drawn a line in the sand and said, you know, we've historically turned away about 4 out of 5 qualified applicants, again, related to sales, because sales create jobs. And I don't think that's okay. I think we need to give every woman who wants to come here a chance to change her life. And we're at the point now where we've proven the model. The 70% graduation rate and nearly 100% job retention at a year far exceeds most of our peers in the country. So the next part of what I'm focused on is looking at how could this be replicated and what would that look like?
You mean replicated in other parts of the country?
Yeah, potentially. And, you know, some of the challenge of replication is that you have this great thing in one community and you really need to figure out what's the secret sauce, what makes this work. And I don't think it's that we make bean soup, but I do think that there are elements of what we do that make our program and our business work together. And that's what we need to figure out in order to figure out what replication might look like.
What? I just lost my train of thought. So you would like to see this organization expand to other cities. Is that also now part of your task?
That is one of the things that I'm focused on. I love my job because I get to focus on what's next and I get to be the visionary leader of this organization. And what that means to me is that I get to paint a picture of and say, hey, everybody, let's go over there. And I don't know how we're going to get there, but won't it be great when we do? I'm lucky because I love doing that. And I get to do that every day.
I can't believe I waited this long to ask, how do people get in touch and connect with the Women's Bean Project? And how can I make a match? And how do I know where you sell your products?
Well, you can find us on at womensbeamproject.com, and on our website you can find the stores where we're sold in your local community. So anyone who is looking to find out where there's a store down the street, they can visit our website to find it.
So there's bean soup, there's chili, there's cookies, like you said, there's brownies. What do you see expanding in terms of what more do you want to offer?
We're going to make some changes that really are more current in terms of how people are eating today. People are much more interested in trying unusual flavors, for instance, and also need convenience. You know, our mixes are actually quite convenient. They're really pretty dummy proof. You just put the baking mix in the bowl and add, say, eggs and butter, and you've got a brownie mix. So we're pretty easy to make, but we're going to be adding some things like a global fusion beans and rice in a cup. So you could have that for lunch. It's just you either add boiling water or microwave it and let it sit.
I could even do that.
You could. And we're also going to be introducing a line of biscuit mixes with jams, icebox jams. They're just a really quick and easy mix that for the jam that you put on the stovetop, cook it for about 10 minutes, and you've got jam to go with your biscuits.
Tamara, I want to switch gears for a minute, and I want to talk about the book that you wrote, The Third Law. Explain what the book is all about.
Well, I found that I'd been at the Bean Project for a number of years, and again, I learned things that were really counter to what I now know were my biases and prejudices coming into this job. I grew up in a white middle-class family and had no reason to know someone who'd been incarcerated or someone who'd been an addict or even someone who'd been on welfare. And I partly realized that, but for the accident of birth, the only difference between me and another and a woman who came to the Bean Project was that I just happened to be born to a family that going to college was expected and creating a career and putting off childbearing until I, you know, was married was an expectation. But those were just the norms of my community. And I realized that those aren't the same norms across the board. I also realized that many of the women who come here, or most of the women who come here, are really brought down by the biases and prejudices that our society has. That we have in our country a very, very much a pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality. And there is an expectation that if you live in poverty, it's really your own fault. Huh. And you should just be able to get yourself out. And so all of these things conspired to make me realize that I needed to talk about that because the women don't have a voice. And I have the opportunity to be able to tell their stories so that others could see that it's really not as simple as someone is an addict or someone is a felon. That you know, if you grow up the youngest child of two drug addicts with no role models for employment, what do we as a society really think should happen? I mean, how would she know that she needs to finish school and put off childbearing to avoid living in poverty and then get a job? I mean, why would she know that? Because that wasn't the norm in her community. So I decided that how I wanted to write this book was by telling the women's stories. And so there are about 75 different women in the book, and I talk about the issues that they all face. I talk about what I've learned along the way, but I do it in the context of telling their stories as well.
So it's a how-to book. In addition to sharing stories, that this might also be a catalyst for other people to maybe start something like a Women's Bean Project.
I think it also is at its most basic, what I hope is that it's a catalyst for people to see that it's not as simple as we want to believe, that there is poverty that exists down the street from us and that we could do something about it. But first, we need to change our attitudes and opinions about that.
Yeah, not an easy task. As you were telling me this, and one of the things that just sort of jumps out is for the women who have been incarcerated, you know, not for nothing. Here you are in prison. It's an age-old question. Why are these skills not being shared there? You know, you've got a captive audience that you can help, you know, with whether it's psychological services or life skills services.
Well, a lot of that really has to do with that we've incarcerated so many people. So the prisons are overcrowded. Between 1977 and 2004, the female inmate population grew 757%. they didn't have the means to build more prisons. And so prisons are crowded. So the services are usually non-existent.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's a huge problem. So we're basically warehousing people and then and dehumanizing them, because we, when you are convicted and you go to prison, you have a number. And so you're not a person anymore. You're a number. When you, when you're finally what's called off paper, you're finished with your sentence. The expression is you kill your number. And so we make someone a number, and then we release them into the community after being dehumanized and say, okay, now we need you to become human again. We don't have the means to give you the skills to do that. We're just going to expect that you can figure it out. And that's what I see as the biggest problem, because women come back into the community and they have to create whole new lives for themselves, because in many instances, they can't associate with people that they associated with before.
Exactly. You really have to start from ground zero again.
As a society, we are addressing in as many ways as we need to the ramifications of our drug sentencing laws, which increase the number of people in prison exponentially.
And I gather that that must have been the topic for your TED Talk as well, which to get out there and let people know what's going on.
My TED Talk was about that, and as much about that as this overarching idea that when you believe in someone, when you believe in their ability to change their lives, you give them the opportunity to believe in themselves. And that, to me, is the key difference. It's rather than expect someone to just figure it out, first you have to believe that they can do it. And I think in general, well, I would say the women we hire don't feel that anyone believes in them.
That they must feel just so all alone. Share one or two, as we're kind of running out of time, but success stories where the women have gone on to what?
Well, one of my favorite stories is a woman named Gloria. And Gloria came to us. She was dangerously thin, was wasting away. She had no belief in herself or her abilities, because she had been in an abusive marriage. And when that marriage ended, her ex-husband took their kids and left the state. And so she came to Colorado. She was actually out of state. She came to Colorado to be with some family, but she kept losing her jobs because she didn't think she was worthy. She ended up in a homeless shelter, and that homeless shelter referred her to Women's Bean Project. Gloria told me the story that on the first day she arrived, she said to our case manager, you know, I've lost my voice. And our case manager just said to her, I'm listening. And that was the beginning of Gloria beginning to change her life. And when she graduated our program, we convinced one of the local businesses to give her a chance and hire them at her front desk, at their front desk. And she still works there. So it's been a little over 12 years. And now, for going from this, taking a chance on this woman to work at their front desk, she now manages 5 other women. And so she heads up all of their clerical staff. She owns a home. She owns a car, and she's on the verge of getting her college degree.
Oh, man.
And I think that one of the things she said, I said, well, Gloria, how would you describe yourself now? And she said, well, I'm a hard worker. I'm a loyal friend. And she stopped for a second, and she looked at me and said, and I'm fabulous.
I can't think of a better way to end this fabulous conversation. Oh, Tamara, we're so grateful for women like you who do what you do in the organizations that they're affiliated with. Let's give the website address.
We can be found at womensbeanproject.com. And on our website, not only can you buy products and learn more about us, but you can also find the stores where our products are carried in your local area.
And people can also make donations.
Of course, that is great, because that gives us the ability to provide the life skills that really make a difference in a woman's life.
Well, on behalf of everyone, I want to thank you for making a difference. And it sounds to me that you've still have your work cut out for you, as you know, you move into another year and a year after that. And it sounds also like what you do is clearly a labor of love.
Well, thanks, Sandy. I appreciate the opportunity.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And please go to our iTunes store page and leave a rating and a review. And if you know anyone you think that we should interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.